Welcome to What Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined this week by Kyle.
Hey, how's it going?
And Adrian.
Hey, how's it going?
And this week, we're going to talk about stuff that we like. This is an all recommendations episode. If you like that part at the start of our show where we just talk about things we're enjoying, that's all this is going to be. So if you're looking for a new show, a comic, a game, whatever, we have it for you. But before we dive into that stuff and all the things that we're reading and enjoying, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Blue Sky at KFoleyFL for all of my hottest takes.
Yeah, you can find me mainly on Threads and Instagram at SuperReese93.
All right, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Most Always Alex. And now, that was like the fastest we've ever done the start of the show. Let's talk about stuff that we're into. I tried to structure this in a way that in my head made sense and that would flow. So Kyle, let's start with you. Tell me about this book.
So I have recently been rereading the Malazan Book of the Fallen series. I got introduced to it last year through TikTok. Saw someone that I know talking about it, decided to read. It's a 10-book series written by a Canadian author, Stephen Erickson, who is an archaeologist and anthropologist. That was what he did before he became an author. He had a tabletop game that he turned into a story. So they are these 10 epic novels. It's this huge, like, insane story with, I think there's over 400 POV characters from start to finish. So I read it last year from August until November. And then I started rereading it this year. I've been going a little bit slower. I've been reading like a couple chapters a day. I think I started in like March and I've been slowly making my way through. Mm-hmm. I'm on book 5 now. And it is just, in going back through it, when I finished it, I was like, man, nothing I've ever read has felt like this. And now that I'm going back through it, it's amplifying that feeling where I'm getting so much more out of it because there's so many things where I'm like, oh, this thing that made no sense to me before, now when you know what happens, you're realizing, oh, this was all in motion, you know, ages ago, but there's so much going on that you miss it. So it's one of those things that even the author said in interviews, like, it's meant to be reread.
Okay, so now, when you said that this was based on his tabletop, so this is like fanfic of his D&D group, but it's actually just a really good novel series?
Yeah, they had like a campaign that they were putting together, and then the first book, Gardens of the Moon, was originally supposed to be like a script that they were trying to pitch, and then ultimately he put it into a book. So the first one's a little, people sometimes bounce off on the first book because it very much just throws you into this world that him and his friends had already created. There's actually some spin-off novels by another author, Ian C. Esselmont, who I'm about to get into his books because they kind of weave their way into the series, and they were both a part of this campaign together. So they created the universe, they created the characters, and then he's just gone way more in-depth into what happened and all the different storytelling throughout.
All right. Now, and then you... what's like the basic like premise or conceit? Like, is it just like high fantasy or how's it going?
Yeah.
I also see this started in 1999. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, when you said that Book Talk recommended it, I was like, well, that's a recent thing. But then it looks like the most recent book was like is planned for October.
Yeah. He's got a prequel trilogy and a sequel trilogy that he's been working on. And so I believe the latest book in the prequel trilogy is the one that comes out later this year. I can't remember. I know I haven't pre-ordered. I just don't remember which one it is. I haven't read those yet. I've been waiting until those are completed to touch those.
It is The Tales of Witness Book 2.
Okay.
So if that means anything
that
to
is,
you.
That is the sequel series.
Okay.
So cool. it's... Yeah, so the series is older, but he's been touching it up and adding more to it. People have slowly been getting back into it as they've discovered it. It wasn't this like well-known thing because the barrier to entry is perceived to be really high. When people are talking about it, they're like, hey, you know, this is really great, but it's hard to get into. I think that's overstated. I think that's the thing people say. It can be confusing. There are a lot of things that you won't understand, but that's okay. He throws you in, and there's, like I said, there's over 400 characters. So it's like, I don't know who this person that got introduced is. And they could end up literally never coming back again. Or 5 books later, they could turn out to be like some secret god crazy character. So there's definitely a lot. That's why rereading it is interesting, because you know now, you know the major plot points, and you know here's the big events that happen, so now I can focus more on the details. It's one of those, like, I tell people when I recommend that they read it, I'm like, don't try to learn everything the first time. It's okay to be a little lost and confused. You're going to get the overall premise. You're going to get the overall story. It's okay to miss some of the details. It makes you appreciate it more than when you go back through it.
Yeah. And I honestly, I'm a fan of, yeah, media that like sinks in a little bit more the second time. I think the easiest example to point people to is always Arrested Development, where it's a funny show the first time you watch it. And the second time you watch it, you start realizing how many layers there were and how many jokes were set up like a whole season in advance. And, you know, jokes where the payoff doesn't come until like, you know, the middle of season two, but you realize that they started it in season one. And so, yeah, seeing someone do that in fiction where it's like, oh, if I go back and read that other book, knowing that this character is going to do X, Y, Z later, all of those interactions are now colored by that knowledge. And now it actually is, I would assume, kind of a different book at that point.
Completely, because you're reading it looking for something different. You're getting, I mean, I'm on book five right now, and I'm reading through, and the story that I'm paying attention to in this is completely different. The first time I was paying attention to the overarching story that's happening. The second time I'm paying attention to two characters specifically because I know what ends up happening with them and where they play into things. And I know, man, their story and how they get to where they end up is actually what's most important. So it is definitely, it changes what you're paying attention to when you go back through it.
That's cool.
So,
I like that.
Yeah. And
are they in?
Go ahead.
I mean, this sounds. Are they in talks with like bringing it to screen soon?
Did I miss
that part?
I have not seen anything for that. I would imagine it would be really hard to adapt this. I know there's a lot of people have talked on, like, I've seen a lot of Reddit posts like, oh, what if they turn this into a series? I don't know how they could do it. It's very much like the books jump back and forth between different continents, different characters. I mean, I remember my first time reading it. Book one focuses on a group of characters in a city. Book two brings a couple of those characters over to a new continent, but it's a completely new set of characters that it's based around. So and book five is basically goes back in time to before the events of book one. And so you're getting so much jumping around that it'd be really hard to adapt. But I do think one of the things that's interesting that makes it relevant, at least, which would be cool to see adapted in some way, is that there's so many ties into reality. Because of Erickson's background in anthropology and archaeology, there's a lot of things happening with commentaries on colonialism, capitalism. In the book I'm reading now, there's a whole thing about taking down the economy. I mean, there's so many different things that when I read through now, too, because even just, you know, a year later, there's so many things different in the world. And so the things I'm taking away from it are different. One of the quotes that I pulled up that just really speaks to me is there's an event in book two where they are traveling on a thing called the Chain of Dogs. And it's just this mass refugee train trying to make it to the other end of this desert continent. And it's harrowing and it's brutal. And there's a historian character, Duiker, who's there to basically, his goal is to survive so he can tell the story. And he's talking to one of the other characters, one of the military characters, and he says, children are dying. And then the other character responds to him, that's a succinct summary of humankind, I'd say. Who needs tomes and volumes of history? Children are dying. The injustices of the world hide in those three words. And I can't help but look at things that are happening, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in immigrant communities, whether it's wherever we're seeing this happen. That's such a, you take that out of a book and you put that into real life and you go, yeah, that's a pretty succinct way to sum up human history. So he does such a great job of making it feel topical and relevant, where I would love if that message was put more in another medium for people to enjoy, because these books are tough. They are tough to get through. There's a lot, but it would be so hard to adapt that. But man, would I love to see someone try to figure that out.
Yeah. I was going to say, it seems like they would need to simplify a lot, because even if they don't do 400 POV episodes of something, you still theoretically have 400 named characters. And I feel like that's where you get into an adaptability issue of like, how do we do this without like condensing things? And at that point, you're cutting people's favorites. Like, it kind of, if anything, to me, it reinforces that a story necessitates a certain medium. Like, it just isn't going to work in a different format. Not that I think this is like impossible to adapt. I just think it would be a really big challenge and a really big undertaking to pull it off. From a perspective of like production and getting things done quickly. And I mean, if you have that many characters who, you know, are theoretically going to get screen time, filming in a timely manner where it's not animated. That's true. Animation would probably go a long way, because I'm thinking
I'm thinking about like my favorite ones that are now getting things that are animated similar to this. A lot of like the things that you're saying, Kyle, are things I like about like the Cradle series or the Beginning After the End series, and those both through Kickstarters and things like that are getting animations. And I never thought, like, because again, they're books that are require deep amounts of time, 12, 13 book series. So this one being even longer, it's tough to do, but you know, anything's possible.
Well,
especially in animation.
Yeah. And I think too, like, I've always been a huge reader. So for me, it's like, if something has an adaptation, I'm reading the book first. That is just, I have to do it. It's been ingrained in me. That was growing up. I wanted to watch Lord of the Rings and I wasn't allowed to do it until I read the books. So that was always such a huge thing for me is reading adaptations. So it is as someone who enjoys books and oftentimes thinks they are better than adaptations, even good adaptations, I always think it's best to read the book.
Yeah.
I would love to see someone somehow tackle this, because I would love to see more people go, oh man, I really want to get into these books. And now I have kind of a general understanding of the world. Now I can go into the books, which you mentioned Cradle. I love that series. And I'm so excited to see Will Bright. I'm so excited. He's a fellow Florida man. I learned that today.
Yeah. He's such a nice man. I met him at Comic-Con last year. He's such a sweet man.
Yeah. Books have such a niche audience comparatively. I know it's been growing. Book Talk's been exploding. I know Barnes & Noble that closed down here in 2020 just reopened. Like, it's been great. There's been a bit of a boom, but I think adaptations often bring more people to the table that otherwise might not have heard.
Especially like when projects, and I ask if there's talks of it, because I think that the power of Cradle getting going was, you know, Family Affair, Kickstarter, boom, get it. Critical Role, Kickstarter, boom, animated series. Now we're here. You know, things that I never thought listening or reading are getting them now. So I think if there's like a big enough push in the community for it, I think I do, but then I went to go Google to just see if there's any kind of talks. And I saw one article from him talking in Spain that they were in talks, but that was like a year ago. But it was way more often than not Reddit threads of people saying that like Hollywood would never do this series justice. So I don't know if this fans would even want that to be a thing. So
yeah, I do think that's fair. And Alex kind of mentioned that one of the troubles of doing that is like you leave out characters. You always have to make cuts. When you do any sort of adaptation, even the best adaptations make cuts and changes. And I used Lord of the Rings as an example earlier.
Tom Bombadil.
I reread the Lord of the Rings series at least once a year, sometimes twice. And I watch the movies multiple times a year. Those are such an ingrained part of my childhood and my life that I love them. But there are drastic differences and drastic changes that in some ways are good and in some ways are not quite as good. The Malazan community is very active and very big fans of the work. I wouldn't say it's a toxic environment, because I've not experienced that. I've been on the subreddit now for about a year and all of my encounters have been really good, but there is definitely a lot of like everything that's done here is for a reason and it all builds to something else. And so by changing that, you inherently change part of the story. If you take someone's story and you remove it from you take a couple of different POVs and you condense them down into one character, it kind of diminishes the effect that Erickson was going for. So that is something that I feel even as a fan, like as cool as it would be to see an adaptation, I'm one of those who's like, man, I just don't know if it'd be a good way for people to get into it, but I don't know if it could ever do it justice.
Yeah, that sounds fair. I mean, because it seems like it's, you know, kind of treated as sacred to some degree, like you don't mess with it. I will say in my head, I've always flipped whether or not you should read the book before watching the adaptation, because for me, the book is sort of the canon and it sets like this is the true intention. So I am more irked by negative changes when I know the canon. And then when I go read the book, I'm like, oh, that was really cool. That was even better than what I just watched. But I still enjoyed what I watched.
Yeah.
But I recognize that doesn't work for everyone. But like I know, I think my sister had that experience with The Shining. She watched the movie, loved the movie, then read the book and was like, oh, that was real different. But still liked both of them in the end. I feel like sometimes it's like if I read it and then I watch it, I end up hating what I watched because it was too different from what I read. Which I guess that also goes down to the quality of the adaptation.
Yeah, well, and the spirit of the adaptation. Like one of the things, one of the more recent adaptations is the Silo series. And it takes, and Pachinko is another good example. Those are two things where I read the books recently and have watched and really enjoyed the television series. They change up a lot of the order of events and the way things happen and the way, even the structure of the storytelling is done differently.
Yeah.
But because it's done and it's enveloping the same spirit of the books, even though the story beats are maybe a little bit different or done differently, the overall impact and the overall goal is the same. But I do think a lot of that is it's the spirit of in the way that the adaptation is done and the way that someone is approaching the adaptation.
Yeah. If
I'm one of those people where I go into something and I want to enjoy it, whether I'm watching a show, a movie, reading something, whatever, I go in and I want to leave whatever that thing is and go, man, I'm glad I spent time with that. So for me, an adaptation, if it's different, I'm always looking for, like, did I still get the same feeling? Did I still get the same, even if it's not quite as good, are they at least going, or are there things where it just feels like you just did this just to find a new avenue to make money? I think the How to Train Your Dragon live action was an example of that, where it's like, I could just...
it was great. It was great.
It's beautiful. It was great. Do you know why it was great? Because the source material was great, which is a movie that you can go back and watch.
A new medium of people who are kids who have never seen the animated series, who can't be bothered to see that. But, you know, mom takes them to go see How to Train Your Dragon. They go back and watch How to Train Your Dragon, see How to Train Your Dragon 2, find out that How to Train Your Dragon has it. It's just different gateways. Different gateways to the thing.
That one was okay.
Because the changes aren't bad. All they did was give us good source material. I think a bad example from this year is like Lilo and Stitch. That's a bad example of like where you change the source material because you thought you had a better take on the thing. Like the canon material, like Alex was... I don't know how to change it. That's fair. I had to find my boys.
Listen, I love
mainly because I want to see the second one. I think it's just the cave scene.
I think it's just for me. I always, when there is older media, the people that create it and the work that was put into it, I personally am always a proponent of go enjoy that older media. Like when I see that there are movies that are remakes of, especially if it's like older movies from like the 50s and 60s, I was like, go watch the original. Like the original exists and is really good. I personally am not a super big fan of adaptations of things. Like I said, unless I feel like this is a, if it's a completely new avenue, like book to movie or show where it's like, okay, not a lot of people are going to read, but a lot of people might go see a movie and then maybe it piques an interest in reading. Growing up, obviously there's different things with the series now, but Harry Potter was really big when we were all younger. And a lot of that was because of the movie adaptations, which then got people into the books, which is then what made it such a worldwide thing. So adaptations definitely serve a really good purpose. I think Melazin is one of those things that as cool as it would be to see it have that sort of cultural impact, unfortunately it won't happen, but the books exist.
Just read the book.
The books are incredible.
And now more people know. I didn't know about it before this episode, so now I can go check it out.
Do you know who does the audiobook? I'm an audio. I like a good movie in my head.
So there are two problems with the audiobooks for Melazin. One is the first two or three books are narrated by someone different than the last ones. And because there's so many POV characters, it's very hard to distinguish the difference in who's talking and who's doing what with the audiobooks. It's not even a criticism of...
Oh, they didn't do different actors per character.
No, it's all one narrator, which is fine if you only have a handful of characters, but when you have 50, 60 POVs in a book, it can be very easy to mix up names. I know some of the pronunciations are really whack, but obviously if you're reading, like that's not a huge impact. I actually listen to a follow-along podcast. I listen to the 10 Very Big Books podcast. They go through like chunks at a time where it's like it's one guy who read the books before and the other people on it had never read them. So they go through like three chapters at a time, talk about it. And it starts off very much, they're all kind of lost what's going on. And as it grows, you know, they're getting more into it. But I think that's a good medium if you're trying to read but have a companion way to follow along. That's
nice little book club.
Yeah, I love audiobooks. I think audiobooks are great.
I love audiobooks.
That's a series that I would say maybe steer away from the audiobooks just because it does take away from some of the impact.
Ralph
Lister. You're just missing who the different characters are and who the little things are.
Yeah, for sure.
And one more time, that was, how do you say it?
Melazin, Book of the Fallen.
by Steven Erickson. So yeah, go check it out. Now, keeping on the high fantasy theme, Adrian, tell us about your thing.
Yeah, I've been talking about Baldur's Gate, I think, for 6 years now. I was going through an old phone, and it had like the press release thing for the beta for Baldur's Gate 3, mm-hmm. which if you haven't played Baldur's Gate 3, don't know about Baldur's Gate 3, in the same kind of Dungeons & Dragons theme, it's Larian Studios, I think, one of the best games in the last like 10 years. I love this game so much. I probably have hundreds of hours in it solo. Yeah. But what I've really, really enjoyed and what I'm telling everyone to go pick up and spend $60 on or whenever it's on sale is to go pick this game up because it's so much better playing with someone else. Even if you're just watching someone else's playthrough, back to kind of like what you're saying about that book series, like as you're talking, like the characters you meet in Baldur's Gate matter way later, way differently depending on like party makeup, where I've played maybe 12 campaigns now and I feel like every time I'm finding out new things, and I'm not someone who's like going through as a completionist and going on like forums to make sure I'm getting everything. I'm just playing the games, but what really has just made it better is playing with like my partner, because I'm getting to like watch my wife play this.
The multiplayer element on that is a really cool thing that they built in.
Yeah, and we got it on Xbox, and it has really, really great couch co-op where the split screen works well enough. You guys can, you know, you get a person, or the way that we split the party anyway is my wife got Lysel, I got Karlach, and then those were just like our partners through the game, and we just like played it out that way. So it was really nice just to be able to see how she approaches problem solving in a much bigger way than like playing Portal or playing Split mm-hmm. Fiction,
which there's like there's set fixes for those games exactly. a lot of the time.
Yeah, so
that's why I was excited about that Lego Voyager game, mm-hmm. where it's like you are playing as a Lego piece, and the things that you can build are like the way that you would match Legos together in real life. And I feel like that adds for a lot of flexibility and creativity. And that's why I'm excited about that game. The idea of like, in Baldur's Gate, you can see how someone handles problems more complexly.
Yeah.
A written solution.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't get over the fact that the game is still just $60. And I've just put so many hours into it that like, if you're looking for a game to play with someone, as for my part of the recommendations here for a co-op experience, go play Baldur's Gate 3. I don't know if you've played it at all, Kyle, or how much you.
I've got about 20 hours in it. I played it for a while and then I bounced off of it just because I got busy. But the thing that I appreciated about it was I knew nothing about Baldur's Gate and I had never really played a game in that style. And I did not feel it any way like it was unapproachable. I felt like it was really easy to get on board with both the story and how to play the game. As soon as I picked it up, was going through, I was like, it was why I dropped it, knowing that I can come back to it and not feel like I have to relearn the controls, which I've had to do with plenty of other games where it's like, I haven't touched this in 6 months. I don't remember how to play. It's very intuitive. And it is, like you said, it's so easy to explore different avenues and different ways of problem solving. And there is no right way. So it's easy to approach coming into it with a do whatever you think is right in this situation. Yeah. Like
what take should your I do own approach. Here? Whatever you want. And then whatever you do, we'll just figure it out. And it's such like and for anyone who's played tabletop RPGs or played D&D, it really is that experience in such the most authentic way possible. And I think there's other games that do this very well now. I think I've talked about Sunderfolk. Does it pretty well. Whims of Aria is another game that does it pretty well. But like, this is traditional D&D where you're leveling up to 12 and you can multi-class. You can take it as seriously as you want. The mod community has been fantastic and amazing through and through. The story is beautiful. You know, we were in tears by the end of it. And then we got to go have like a little party and stuff. It was just
how long is it? Because that's the part that complicates the co-op for me.
Our campaign finished play by time on the Xbox for this campaign, 112 hours.
Okay, so you do have to find someone that you want to hang out with for 112 hours.
Yeah, which is like my partner. So
find
it was really
regular time. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'm like, I could play this with my partner. Yeah. I don't know that I could like find a friend to pick it up and also play it with them.
Yeah, it's tough. Good thing is though that the drop in and drop out is very easy. So like someone can come in, make a character, they come in, and then they would just take the spot of one of the origin characters for that day. And then, you know, it's so even in that way, you can have people come in if someone's just plopped on the couch, or if you're streaming on the computer. I think either way works really well. Plays well on the Steam Deck, which I think is fantastic. So it's very, very accessible in more ways than mm-hmm. one. And really rewards the players, like you're saying, kind of like for trying things, whether it's dialogue options or creativity. Or I think like I told you I put 112 hours. I watched a 18-minute speed run.
Mm-hmm.
The time that went into this game is crazy. And I know that's one of like the things in some of the I was in a press conference the other day, and they're talking about like Baldur's Gate 3 shouldn't be the thing everyone should expect because they spent so much time on it. And to talk to, you know, playing the originals, I didn't play Baldur's Gate 1 or 2 or really any game mm-hmm. like it, but able to jump into Baldur's Gate 3, remember that I love D&D, and then go find other avenues to do it. But more importantly, I think it just really, really helped me bond with my partner for 112 hours on the couch, watching mm-hmm. her romance and like play to whatever that is, and look like how she fell in love with a character that she had no idea. She had full intentions of romancing these characters. Yeah. The choices didn't work. She didn't like the choices that she was making, but this character didn't. And then by the end, they have a baby.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, you know. And then I romance a different character after not being able to do it in another playthrough because we didn't know that if this person died, we couldn't save them over here. So it was just so much of like finding the right circumstances for our playthrough, but worked out so well. Not really scum saving, but like when we wanted to like a role to go our way, making a role go our way. So really is mm-hmm. your experience and who you're playing with, I think, speaks a lot to
totally
it. Yeah,
I feel like I have such a love-hate relationship with things that are missable in games, because mm-hmm. I feel like if the game is like 8 hours, playing it again to get a different outcome is one thing for me, but when a game yeah. is like 50 hours and it's like, oh, you messed that up, like now you can't get XYZ achievement, yeah. you have to replay the game, and that's where I'm like, this is stupid.
Yeah,
like there's,
I think, yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, if the game is good, I'll probably be willing to do it if I like just want to immerse myself in the world. So that's kind of where I'm like, I do sometimes like it, but other times I'm like, oh, I like, I'll get that achievement in 3 years when I get around to playing this game a second time.
No, yeah. I mean, the first time I played it was in 2019 for like the alpha for But Why Though. And then I played it with like no one else knew what was going on. So mm-hmm. a guy that I miss at the very beginning of the game, who's, you have to like roll a check to pull him out of a portal, basically. I failed the check and then I didn't see the character for the rest of the game. And that was like and now that having played through it again now with my wife and finally seeing that storyline after, you know, 6 years, I didn't really care to like save him in any of the other playthroughs. I didn't save him the first one. Why save him in the other ones if I, or why worry about failing if it didn't really affect too much? And then, you know, seeing it play out in a different playthrough is rewarding, but also makes me feel like, yeah, I shouldn't have grabbed Gale out of that portal. I don't like him. So
I'm with Alex where I'm one of those, like, I don't like missing things, and I also don't like having to like comb through a game to find all the little things. But the thing that I was experiencing with my time in Baldur's Gate 3, and you can maybe talk about this a little bit more, you don't really feel that FOMO because the choices, it's all so organic. It's all, when you make a choice and something happens, it feels like this is exactly what was meant to happen. And I imagine even when you're doing a second playthrough and you do something different, it still feels that natural.
Yeah, it definitely feels that natural. Nothing. Yeah, it's, you are so, I think as many hours as I've played, because we went from 112 hours, and as soon as the credits rolled and we saw all the things, and Larian did this like beautiful end credit sequence, she was like, okay, let's do an evil playthrough. And then we jumped into like an evil playthrough. And then even in the first thing, we're having different things happen. Cool. You know, so it feels natural based on the choices your character is making. And it makes you feel like, yeah, you're him, you know, or her, or they.
That's cool. I like that.
In a relationship with one or multiple people, or nobody, or you're just like the dark urge, where it's literally you have the urge to kill, and you have to make character choices on whether or not do you indulge that urge or do you suppress it. Then that's like a whole other storyline off of instead of like an honor mode playthrough, you can just pick a different character storyline, Yeah. Or play through it as one of the origin characters and see what that like. So there's multiple ways to experience it, and you really don't miss out. Like, we had a character die, and we're like, I guess we just don't get to see his storyline. I guess we get to focus on this other character more this time around. So, ipso facto, go play. If you have a partner to play with, please
go play Baldur's Gate 3.
Baldur's Gate 3.
And my game, my thing, my high fantasy part of this is Elden Ring Nightreign, which I don't remember. Neither of you are Souls-like people.
I'm not, but I loved Elden Ring, and I bought Nightreign. I haven't actually played it yet, but that's the franchise that kind of got me into maybe I can appreciate Souls-like games.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I picked this up. My friends and I play games together once a week, just as a way to like stay connected. And so we were playing Monster Hunter Wilds, and then we had played Elden Ring together. So we decided, which also meant we played Elden Ring 3 times. Basically, we did every boss fight on everyone's file, because Elden Ring, when you do online, it doesn't like sync your boss progression. So did Melania 3 times, did everything 3 times, did the DLC 3 times. And it also scales difficulty. So that game took forever. This game, it's basically a boss rush, and the gameplay loop on it is simultaneously really satisfying and also a little bit frustrating. It uses that battle royale shrinking circle mechanic, which is cool, but when you're not necessarily like fully immersed in the knowledge of the game, having to read like what a weapon does and decide whether or not you want to pick it up, knowing that there's like a wall closing in, adds like a pressure and a stress that I'm not sure always is welcome. Sometimes it's fun. Other times we're like in the basement of a castle and we see the firewall come into the room that we didn't realize was that close. And it's like, well, shit, now everyone has to like panic. We have to sprint out of here. We have to hope that the exit is on the right side of the building, because we don't remember where we came in. And
it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that part's stressful. The gameplay loop of like, I mean, where Souls likes always shine, I think, is, you know, obviously environmental storytelling, but the boss fights. And this game, it's a boss rush. Like, you are just killing as many bosses as you can to level up as much as you can before the end of each day in game, and then fight another boss. Each run is a 3-day cycle if you last that long. If you die if you get a party wipe, I think that's what ends the run. But if you die and your teammates are alive, you respawn, but you lose a level and you drop your souls. So then you have to go back, get your runes. You're still down a level, which like there have been runs where that has completely like sank us, because we end up being just slightly underpowered for what we need to be up against. But it's been really fun. There's a good repetition to it and a speed. You have to unlearn a lot of what Elden Ring taught you, because you can't move slow. You don't have time to take things in. It is like you run and you kill and you try to not die. And that's the whole game. But I love it. I've been having a really good time with it. There have been a couple of times where we just have like bad run after bad run. And that's just like random number generator of like, oh, like the boss is weak to this kind of weapon, and we're not getting that kind of weapon dropping.
Did you play Helldivers?
I didn't play Helldivers.
It sounds like a little bit like Helldivers, like that kind of like gameplay loop of like jump in, and the more you play, the better you're going to get. But it's probably going to be hectic the entire time. But that's kind of like the point. Yep. Yeah.
And there's like some minimal.
But it's fun because you're doing it with friends, I imagine.
Yes.
I think that's my issue with single
players brutal.
Yeah, that's my issue with Souls-like games. It feels like I'm just punching myself in the nethers just over and over again. And I'd rather like punch myself in the nethers like with my friends, I think that's why Helldivers was so fun. We're all punching yourself, you know. I don't know.
That's fair.
I don't know if that says about me, but it's how I feel about Souls like.
Oh yeah. And I think with Elden Ring the challenge is it scales the difficulty up when you have other people with you. And if one of those people dies, it doesn't scale the difficulty back down. So like when we were playing Elden Ring proper, if the two people who had come into your file to help you die during the boss fight, you are just stuck fighting the hardest version of that boss by yourself.
That's not a drop in come play with me. That's like,
yeah, it's a commitment. But yeah, that's my high fantasy thing to contribute.
That's cool. Do you feel like it? I know that there's metas and things like that in Souls-like games. Like Dark Souls and stuff. Do you feel like someone you have to have, if you're not going in with a bunch of swords, then no one's gonna have a good time. Can you be a caster? Like, does those metas work?
There's seven different characters that you can choose from, and it's kind of like recognizable archetypes. Like, there's, you know, like tankier characters, there's all arounders, there's casters, there's like fast moving character, like glass cannon builds. So you pick what works for your gameplay style, and your teammates pick what works for them, and then you just kind of go and try. And you only have your starting weapon. The only thing you can do to affect a run is there are like charms that you can apply to your characters, and those will give you different like starting modifiers. And you earn those by playing through the game. Like, no matter where your run ends, you get a couple. I think typically. So you can do some stuff to tweak it and put things a little in your favor, but ultimately it comes down to like what weapons drop after bosses, like what can you do? And that's where things like weaknesses can be so important. Like, strategy. We did one run where we got all of the weapons that we needed for the boss. Like, everyone was fully kitted out for it. We were at a good level to fight the final boss. And then the boss before that one was resistant to the weapons that we had found.
No.
And it was also just an incredibly difficult boss on its own.
Yeah.
And so we got wiped. Like, we tried really hard and we just all got killed.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's fun, but you just have to know that there's going to be times where the game is working against you, which I recognize is not for everyone.
Yeah. I like it. Nice little, same, but different.
Yeah, for sure. And then my next thing was, have you guys been watching Don Dadon? Yes. Did you watch season one?
Yes.
I watched season one, and I'll be doing Don Dadon stuff at Comic-Con this week. So Okay. Yeah.
So season two just started. I think two episodes are out. Third episode, I think, drops maybe tomorrow or Saturday.
Yeah.
And those first three episodes were packaged as a movie and in theaters. I missed it somehow. I knew it was coming. I think I was just like busy. It was like a one night only type thing. But if you like Don Dadon, this is more of that. It is high strangeness, just really, really weird anime. For those of you who didn't watch season one, you guys tell me if this is a fair summary. Boy who believes in aliens and girl who believes in the occult get powers from the other one's interest. Like, she gets alien powers, he gets occult powers, and then they have to work together to like save themselves and try to get things back to normal. Is that like kind of it?
Yeah.
There's also like a witch who stole his balls. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, it's trying to like, I think it's like you're trying to explain like Rick and Morty, you know?
Yeah, there's not a good explainer, but if you like anime and if you like weird, this is that. And I think that's what captured it for me, is like, I really like these characters and I think it's a really powerful concept. It's also impossible to explain succinctly. And the animation, honestly, I think I've just been really impressed with. Like, they've done really cool stuff with everything. This new season starts off with an arc about like a village with people. And I'm trying to remember what's a spoiler and what's just part of the story. But it starts off with like normal village and very quickly escalates into like, no, this village is weird and the people in it are weird. And we need to get out of here, basically. And yeah, I really like it. And I think that more people should watch it. It's on Netflix, so you probably have access. But yeah, that's my very quick plug for that show.
Yeah.
There's only two episodes. It's hard for me to talk about it more than that.
No, I mean, but you know, I think if you haven't watched it, the voice actors are fantastic. I can tell you from meeting them, like a lot of care goes into this show. Momo's voice actor is not the same person. She's in the thing. So like, there's lots to go back and look at, especially now with season two coming out. So you'll know after the first episode, I think. One of those kind of shows where if you're into that for the first episode, you're going to be into
the wild ride that
that's
that
a good point. Yeah, you kind of know right away if this is for mm-hmm. you.
You don't need a. This is not a big investment. Either you like it or you don't.
Yeah, and honestly, I would say if you are even a little intrigued to watch the second episode, then it's probably for you.
Yeah, exactly. You're rewarded for the deeper you go, I think the more you're rewarded. I think when you watch it.
I will give
as someone who's going back to go rewatch it this weekend.
We'll give a warning though to people that do not watch a ton of anime. The first episode is definitely off the rails. There are definitely things where you just should go in knowing that it's insane and knowing that the series is, that's not the point of the series. Like, there are lots of things that are absolutely just bananas and it's hysterical, but it definitely, just understand that it's a little weird, but it is, if you enjoyed the story beats of it and you just like, man, that part was a little weird, I would encourage you to keep going because it is great.
Yeah, it takes itself seriously for sure.
Yeah.
Kyle, this next thing, I feel like I have to tell us that we can only talk about it for like 10 minutes because I know that I will go on forever, but talk to us about what you've been watching.
So I have recently, and I am now fully caught up in time for the viral video episode. I've been watching through Game Changer on Dropout.tv.
Yeah.
It is just the most ridiculous, creative. Like, I feel like there's not a lot of, like, game shows isn't really a thing like it used to be. I remember when I was younger, like, watching Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune every night was a thing I did, probably because I'm a giant nerd, but also because, like, that was just a thing people did. It's not really as culturally impactful today. I think Game Changer is starting to change that. For those of you unfamiliar with Game Changer, it is a show where the entire premise is the show changes every episode. So the contestants come in and they don't know what kind of game they're going to be playing. And the first season, like, oh, they're playing some fun little improv games and fun little comedy games. And then by the time you get to season like 6 and 7, you're like, oh, Sam Reich, the host, is committing psychological warfare on the contestants.
Sam Says episodes are a good example of that.
Yeah, they're just...
it's Simon Says, but it gets increasingly manipulative and mean and like. But in a way that everyone knows that they're there for that experience, so you don't feel that bad for them.
Yeah, it is such a, like, and it's gotten me into other, I've gone down the Dropout rabbit hole, I've been watching Make Some Noise, I started watching some Dimension 20, which actually I started looking into because of Baldur's Gate 3, kind of getting me into that like D&D type kick, so kind of ties in with that, but... Yeah, these are just the sheer creativity and the game show approach is one of those things like I wish everyone would watch. It's not something I'm going to recommend my parents go watch because it can be a little out there at times, but it is just easily one of the funniest, but also just one of the most creative. And you can really tell, the thing that I really like is you can tell that the people involved all love being a part of the process. They are obviously a company that really respects like their talent and the people working for them. But when you see these people come in, even when they're trying to, you know, get Brennan Lee Mulligan to absolutely lose his mind, like, there's this feeling of everybody here is in on the joke. They're all a part of this community. It's not punching down. It is just being creative and funny while also being kind of, you're watching these people. It's kind of like when you hang out with your friends and you're all sniping at each other and cracking jokes and doing things to kind of set each other off. You get that feeling, and they do such a good job of presenting that feeling on camera that you feel like you're in the room kind of in on the joke with it.
Yeah, there's a really strong camaraderie to it. I mean, the games themselves, I think that show has given me such an appreciation for game design, where there is an episode where the whole premise is just, I'm going to ask you yes or no. And three people are competing for whether or not the answer to yes or no is yes or no. That's the game. And they make it work as a whole game show. It's great. There's a beautiful monologue at the end about psychologically torturing your contestants. But then they also get, like, they just did an episode called Rules Let, which they have the premise for this one from a, and again, brilliant design perspective or design concept. There's a big wheel, not Wheel of Fortune, Price is Right wheel, and they're wearing Velcro bodysuits, and they spin the wheel and it lands on a card, and they peel the card off, and there is a rule on it that they now have to follow, like, don't swear, everything has to be done in your best Christopher Walken impression, be polite, like weird things like that. And then the more tabs get pulled off, they start getting like prompts where, like, okay, I think somebody has to explain photosynthesis while only speaking in questions and being using a sing-song voice and doing their best Christopher Walken. And they and like you're watching these people have to like comprehend all these rules, stack it on top of themselves. And it just gets really complicated and advanced. They did, I think another one that gets a lot of praise and rightfully so is Beat the Buzzer, where they take away the contestants' podium buzzers and they have hidden a bunch of buzzers through the studio. And so they, all of the trivia questions they get are really basic, like how many planets are there, that kind of stuff. And then the game is actually finding the buzzer and solving the puzzle for the buzzer. And sometimes it's not a puzzle. One of them is just really, really high up on the ceiling and they have a basket of tennis balls. And so you just have to hit a buzzer with a tennis ball, but like they're not athletic. So that's its own challenge. But I just appreciate that it, the games are so well designed. And I think on top of that, going back to the respect they have for their cast, the way that they pick the right contestants for everything, where they look for who are we playing to the strengths with if we bring them into this, and who's going to be game for this, and who's, you know, like Brennan Lee Mulligan is a hyper competitive person. So when they had the episode where the person who actually gets the points is whoever comes in second, like bringing him in on that was, it was cruel but also hysterical, because he was like, I see the game and I am now torn between winning and doing my best. And he, and the fact that he is up for that and he knows that this is a good environment for him to enter into that. Yeah, it's, I think, Adrian, are you, have you gone down the Dropout rabbit hole yet?
I've seen some of their, I mean, I've seen some of their stuff on TikTok and stuff. I'm familiar with Dimension 20 for sure. Okay. So I know the concept of their stuff seems fun. You had mentioned YouTube, but you have to like pay to like watch their stuff.
They do have some free episodes on YouTube.
Oh, do they? Cool. Yeah, I'll check out some of the free
episodes. But it's also, I think it's like $6 a month. It's one of the more affordable subscriptions. And they don't take things down, is the nice thing, because they, you also get like all of their old College Humor stuff. One that it's on YouTube, you can watch it for free, that I really liked was Gods of Food. And it's a mockumentary series. I think it's 6 episodes. And it's just kind of ripping apart like 2010s foodie culture in a really funny and I think accurate way. The first episode is about like a guy who has like a food truck that just sells grilled cheese sandwiches, and everyone heralds him as a genius. And like, he's just this like really rough around the edges, horrible person. But it's, you know, again, if like, maybe it's just because I was in Portland in that era, I was like, oh, this is very real. Like this, the grilled cheese food truck that is, that everyone praises and charges, you know, 15, 20 bucks. That's a very real thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kyle, this is a great one to bring in. Game Changer is genuinely one of the most fun shows I'm watching lately.
I will add one note too. Dropout has a very strict password sharing policy, which is that you should share your password with someone who can't afford a subscription for whatever reason. They actively encourage, they are very, not only are they pro the people that work for them, they are also pro the consumer who is buying their content. Like Alex said, they're not removing stuff. They're encouraging you, like, hey, if you've got a friend who wants to watch something, share your password. Let them enjoy this. It's okay. Like,
shout out Philo. Philo's the same way.
Yeah, like,
if you want Philo passwords, let me know.
As a company, it feels good to support them. And on top of that, they are making some of the most creative and enjoyable stuff that I have watched in a very long time.
Well, if you want Kyle's password and he go to...
Yep, find me on Blue Sky, shoot me a message. If you need it, I'll hook you up.
But yeah, it's great. I highly recommend it. We will eventually have to do a Dropout episode, I think, in general on this show, but gotta figure out the angle on that and get into it. But yeah, Adrian, what else have you been into and wanting to recommend to people?
I'm not gonna come on the podcast and not recommend Star Wars always. I know that like we're starved for movies and we're starved for TV right now, but there's so much like great stuff going on in the books and the comics. I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with the High Republic era and what's been going on there, but it's been so great, man. And I think I literally went to go get a For Light and Life tattoo this week because it's such a great take on the era. And I think it's very, very accessible, way more accessible than people think. And I just wanted to come talk some gospel on just jump in to one of the really, because we talked about audiobooks earlier. Mm-hmm. Star Wars Audible books are fantastic, especially the ones done. I mean, all of them are great, but particularly the ones with Mark Thompson, I think, are borderline movies.
Is he the narrator or the writer?
The narrator.
Nice.
It has a whole squad and team of really, really great authors. So it's definitely a huge writing room of interconnected things. You talk about like one action going to another, everything happens to everything, mentality in where it's going. And they did the structure a little bit different. I mean, not, I guess, different, but very kind of Star Wars, where we started off in this era. Phase two went back further back, and then phase three is the finishing of the end of phase one. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, so kind of like the 4, 5, 6 going back, and then sequel trilogy kind of.
Are there like reading orders online that you can find to
there
just
is,
tell you?
Yeah.
Okay, because that's the thing that always throws me with comics is I know that a lot of these things will have like a right order to take them in.
Yeah, but, I think for me, I don't think there is. I mean, Kyle, I know if you have, you can let me know what you think on this, but I think that the series is done so well, and the intentionally layer in exposition and things like, especially in the novelizations, that if you just went into any of the novel, you'd be able to pick up where the story is. Star Wars right now definitely feels like they're doing like, this is like presents. So they changed Star Wars Visions Volume 3 to like Star Wars Visions Presents Volume 3 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Right. And kind of going back to like a Star Wars story. So, for my experience with it, I read most of phase one specifically through the comics, because that's what I was reviewing for But Why Though at the time. Great comics. So if you just go through the comics, you can just go through the comics. You can go through the main novelizations just fine, but they'll make references to kind of all the other characters that are going on. So they balance so many different Jedi, so many different storylines, but it feels like, I don't know. Feels like going back to the cookout now in phase three, because I haven't really read a whole bunch of phase three, but I know that the last book just came out and I wanted to know what everyone was talking about before stuff got spoiled, basically. So I basically went from phase one, finished phase one, a little bit of phase two, and then just jumped into the end of phase three. And characters that I know from phase one have had so much things happen to them since I've talked to them, or not since I talked to them, but since I've heard them last or experienced them last, that now I have like a whole laundry list of things to go back and explore through the book series. So I would say start with Trials of the Jedi, see what these Jedi are like and what they're fighting for, and you can kind of like go back the other way. There's, you can go chronologically, but the series, the way that the phases have been set up, they didn't do them chronologically to begin with, to encourage just jump in where you can and trust that the stories will take you to like where you want to go, to characters you want to learn more about. Because some of them are like more prominent in the comic, some of them are more prominent in like the main book series, but they're all treated with like respect, because like all these authors have been working together this entire time, and it's coming to an end. And that kind of bums me out, but I want more people to go back into it, especially the love that Andor gets, this stuff should get, because we've been they're doing the same kind of like, I know where a lot is made of like the Corbin massacre in Andor season two, and like how that's like relevant to real life, but like that stuff that's been going on in Star Wars for like ever. And more than
just this morning, I was actually reading about that, of someone saying like, oh, was that supposed to parallel current events and da da da, and going all the way back to the start of this episode, you know, people have been getting killed for all history. Like this.
Yeah.
Is,
and
the parallel you're seeing is because human behavior continues.
Yeah. And I think that like kind of brought, and I'll just kind of squish my two things here together, is that it really it sent me down on a seeing Star Wars through not just like the lens of like current events, but just like as a history major from college, like going back and researching like my own roots and seeing where the paths have followed in the spirit of the High Republic era and that view of how things work. And I'm going back and honestly, one of the big things that sparked it, I don't know if you guys have caught up on Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but season 17 just came out, and it was the Abbott Elementary crossover, but from the Always Sunny side, which was fantastic. But one of like the big jokes is that the kids don't remember 9/11. They're like, they just don't know what it is. But it just got me going back down the rabbit hole of like my own history. But like the Gorman Massacre is just like, it's a direct, you almost beat for beat the Toxicol massacre that happens to the Aztecs with Cortez, of letting them come in, voice their concerns, doing all these things, box them in, massacre 3,000 Aztecs on the spot who were just trying to do their rituals, right? So it just reminds me of just like Star Wars now more than anything, with no big movies, with no anything other than just what we currently have, and kind of going back to your point earlier at the very beginning, Kyle, of going back and going read through things that you've gone through before and just seeing it through a lens of just more than what you did when you did it the first time has been really great. So just finding those parallels in like our actual real life histories to know that, and heighten the fact, like you said, Alex, this is nothing new. It's just another way of showing it, and remember that like real things happen based on real life things like this. So
yeah, totally. And keeping it on that history note, Kyle, talk to me about this.
So I have been watching a series called A French Village. It's called that, whatever that is in French. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, because even though it's basic words, I don't speak French. But it is a show that inspired the Gorman arc in Andor. It is a show about a fictional French town during the Nazi occupation in the 1940s. It actually stars Thierry Godard, who plays one of the Gorman rebels. And it is going through the lives of these people living in the town, whether it's the mayor, Danielle Larcher, who's having to deal with, he wants to protect his people, but at the same time, he kind of has to play the game. And it deals with that. How do you handle this? How do you handle, you know, they're collaborating. Thierry Godard's character, Raymond Schwartz, is working with, he owns a sawmill and then ultimately buys a concrete factory from a Jewish man. And so you're dealing with all of these really, like, they're collaborating because for part of that, for some of them, it's their only way to kind of stay in business, to stay alive. And there's some that are doing it reluctantly. And man, I don't like this. There's some that are refusing to do it. There's a police officer who's actively engaged in helping the resistance and helping protect some of the Jewish citizens. And then you have some people who are just flat out like, no, this is, I love this. This is so great. Of course, they're right about the Jews and they're right about the communists. And this is all, and it's such a powerful, it hits the same emotional chords that Andor hit, which is you're watching these people in the midst of oppression and you're seeing kind of all of the angles. Everyone involved in all of this is a human. Whether it's the people causing the atrocities, the people going along with it, or obviously, and arguably most importantly, the victims of it all, like there are conscious decisions being made. The people that are choosing to do evil things probably also have done some nice things in their lifetime, but they're ultimately choosing to forsake that humanity to commit atrocities. And there are other people who go, I don't want the atrocities to be committed to me, so I'm just going to be, I guess I'll just be okay with it because at least they're not doing it to me, which is a huge warning alarm siren. Like, look at real life now. There are so many people who do that. So it's such a powerful look at the historical experience of what happened during the Nazi reign and looking at how that influenced the story in Andor, and then looking at how those two things tie together into our current life and things that are happening today. And it's just, it does a great job of bringing all that together.
Nice. And where is that? Is that streaming somewhere? Did you buy a copy?
They were like, there's a, you can watch it on mhzchoice.com is a way to watch it. The first two seasons are free on Plex, so you can watch through there, or you can scour the internet to try to find it. It's not super easy to find. I think you can buy it on like Amazon. So it's not super easy to find. It's a little more obscure. I'm hoping with the popularity of Andor that it gets picked up and people can find it on a streaming service, like a more popular one. But for now, it is relatively hard to find.
All right. And that's A French Village?
Yes.
Name of that one? Yeah. And then my last thing, two things. I've just been getting back into reading comics more, which like I'm always reading them a little bit, but then sometimes I'm like, all right, I gotta go back, gotta get really into it. So I just read, it's a 2023 series, so it was only 7 issues long, called Unstoppable Doom Patrol, which My first question is, are either of you familiar with the Doom Patrol?
The HBO series?
So it is an HBO show. It's been around since the 60s, is when it started.
I know the HBO show. That's about it.
That was my introduction to it, and it's phenomenal. It's a great show. I'm rewatching it right now. But Unstoppable Doom Patrol. So Doom Patrol is, it started out as like a very, I think, sort of standard B-team, like just comic book superheroes. Got revived, I think, in the 80s by Grant Morrison, and that's where it became what it is now, which is a very surrealist comic book that deals with a lot of like heavy themes. You know, everything from like every kind of trauma, I think, at this point has popped up in Doom Patrol, and, you know, using powers and abilities as allegories for all of these things. But it's basically people who have powers that kind of make them weirder outcasts. Like everything is very goofy and silly, but that's kind of all by design. On the TV show, Brendan Fraser plays a race car driver who technically dies in a car crash, but then his brain gets put in a robot body and he becomes Robot Man. There is a woman who is sort of like a Mr. Fantastic power, except if she gets stressed out, she can't control it and turns into a blob. And so it's like, let's talk about, like, you know, ableism and physical appearance and xenophobia, and let's get into like trauma and estranged families, and let's get into abuse and how we piece ourselves back together after these things. And Unstoppable Doom Patrol is a continuation of all those stories, because the series seems very committed to continuity, even between volumes. So even if it's been 10 years since the last one, they still acknowledge everything that happened as having happened. And I appreciate that about it. But Unstoppable Doom Patrol is basically, they are taking in, like, not, it's like a, like an offbeat Professor X, like an off-brand Professor X, who's like, I'm gonna take in all the weirdos and help them learn to like cope with their powers, use their powers, like come it to be at peace with their life. And then obviously there's somebody who doesn't want that, who is fighting them. It's really great art, really fun story, not necessarily groundbreaking. I think they've done more interesting stories with Doom Patrol historically than this one was, but visually it was great. It's only 7 issues, easy to recommend that someone dip in. I think it helps to know about the Doom Patrol before reading it, but I'm not going to say it's a requirement, because it kind of establishes people, I think, fairly quickly. But yeah, that's one. The other comic I've been in, and I've talked about it on this show before, is The Power Fantasy by Kieran Gillen. Are you guys familiar with that title or that author?
Familiar with the author, not the title.
Okay, so The Power Fantasy is kind of, it's very allegorical, and it's very much about the fragility of peace, and specifically the fragility of peace in the face of nuclear weapons. It's a universe where it's superheroes are referred to as atomics, anyone with powers. And the way that you kind of are like graded is like, there's any, like, anyone can be an atomic, but to be a superpower, you have to basically be at a certain power level, and that power level is measured by, if you decided to go on a tear, how many people would you kill in an hour? And so there are like a couple people who it's like, it would be planetary death if they decided it. They, you know, it's nuclear powers, and it's, the whole world is hinged on these, like, there's only, I think, 6 or 7 superpowers in this world, and so the existence of humanity is hinged on these people getting along. And they all have very different views on whether their powers are good or not, what their responsibilities are having these powers in the world. You know, is it their job to keep each other in check? That kind of stuff. Like, alliances are very important, all that. So it's very much an allegory for nuclear power and for, I think, honestly, just like the military industrial complex and our drive to find increasingly powerful ways to kill each other. But it is, it's very good. It's a little reminiscent of The Wicked and the Divine. I'm not sure if either of you read that one. Same author, and that one, the premise is that the gods reincarnate every 90 years, and in their current iteration, they have all kind of just chosen to be pop stars. And so it's a very lengthy examination of our relationship with art and who creates it and who consumes it, our relationship with celebrity, our cultural practices around that, and just kind of like our beliefs of the power that media holds. But yeah, the Power Fantasy is, I think it's 10 issues in. It's Image Comics, who they do a really cool thing where I think all of their volume ones for trade paperbacks are $10 because that's the best entry point for the series. You know, keep it cheap, get people in, get them hooked. So yeah, The Power Fantasy by Kieran Gillen and Unstoppable Doom Patrol are my two big comic recommendations currently.
Adding both of those to my list to go check out because those sound fascinating.
Yeah, and I think I need to go back and finally read the Grant Morrison run where he made Doom Patrol what it is now, because I, like Adrian was saying, like, I know the HBO show, and the HBO show is amazing, but they are characters that the more I see them, I'm like, I want to know more. Like, I want more of this world. I want more of this fleshed out. They did a really weird crossover in the 2010s called Milk Wars, where it was Doom Patrol was on Young Animal, which was an imprint that DC was running with Gerard Way at the head. And they basically pitched to him, we want to do a crossover between Young Animal and DC. And so he came up with this really weird premise that basically about like rewriting history and revisionism and overwriting reality to be something new and to conform it to your will. And it got titled Milk Wars, and it's really weird, but I really enjoyed it. I very much enjoyed surrealism. So I recognize that Doom Patrol is also maybe not for everyone, but it's very much for me.
I like it.
All right.
Yeah. Anything that deconstructs Power Fantasy too, I'm with.
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. Read the Power Fantasy. I think you'd really enjoy it. It's great. It's a little bit hard because it does throw you in the deep end immediately with these characters, but you start to get a handle on it. I think that the thing that's interesting to me with it too is, and like an added layer of commentary, is one of the characters is established pretty early on that, as far as anyone knows, including themselves, they're an angel. So now there's this whole component of like, oh, like there is something to the power of religion and how it contends on this scale with nuclear weapons and with the power that it wields. But yeah, I just really enjoy it. But I think that does it for this week. So for those of you listening at home, Kyle, I'm going to let you say the name of that book series. Cause again,
Malazan, Malazan.
Okay. And then Baldur's Gate 3, Elden Ring, Night Rain, Dondadon on Netflix, Game Changer on Dropout, anything Star Wars, but specifically it was Tales of the Jedi or Trials of the Jedi?
Trials of the Jedi. High Republic.
Yeah. And then A French Village, Unstoppable Doom Patrol, and The Power Fantasy. Go check all those things out. We love them. We just talked about them for over an hour. I hope you guys enjoyed those recommendations. And if you want more, we've got it. But Why Though is on Blue Sky at butwhytho.net. You can subscribe to the newsletter, which is free, or you can give us money, which is money, by going to butwhytho.net/support. Everything you give goes towards keeping the site running, paying our writers, making the content that you enjoy. So if you like the show, if you like our site, please consider contributing. We would really appreciate it. But even the newsletter, honestly, again, it's free and it is helpful for the site. Adrian, Kyle, thank you guys so much for joining me. I got a lot of good recommendations out of this and just had a good time. And thank you at home for listening.